How do I full screen? Like S11 and Firefox?
Oh, see the little, this little,
please and thank you.
Sure.
We need to move this way a bit more.
All right.
Just
exit. Ike is on.
It's not wanting to move the that direction very easily.
It's good enough. It's good enough.
Yeah.
I mean, as long as we can see the O.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. So, if any of you guys recall, there was a sort of a double binding event that occurred on the evening of whatever.
You have to speak loud until the mic is here. It will be.
Come closer.
Come closer, yes.
So if you guys recall, there were sort of two power events at the end of October during Sandy, one of which was voluntary by Con Ed. They shut down the two substations on the south of Manhattan to prevent like worse damage than they would otherwise sustain. And then unexpectedly for Con Ed, some like 14th Street substation just broke in like spectacular fireworks. And so here we have an aerial photo of what Manhattan looks like shortly after that. So here is like an inverted North Korea, like the fire situation. And up over here we've got like South Korea, prosperous and not really having a care in the world. And our headquarters and our New York data centers are somewhere over here in this black cloud of unlit skyscrapers for about a week. So, when thinking about a data center during Sandy, it helps to think about a data center during Irene. Most people shrug it off because it didn't affect them. And indeed, it didn't affect us, except it scared the crap out of us after the fact. Because looking at the stats, there was a little bit of seawater that came over all the seawalls and piers and stuff and flooded the edges of Manhattan a little bit. And in fact, when we were sitting over there overnight during Irene in 2011, we got warnings from our building managers that Con Ed threatened to shut down the same substations that they did in fact shut down, like at any minute. But we're told that it narrowly avoided happening because it didn't feel that there was sufficient danger to do that and cut power for like 20,000 people who live down there. So just throughout all this, keep in mind that it was very close to being as bad as it was in 2012. Okay. So independently of Sandy, because we like to have uptime, we do some general things to sort of maintain readiness for this kind of thing. If we don't get a week's advance notice from the weather channel that this is going to happen and kill everybody. We've got two data centers in New York City. We've got NY1 on the 21st floor. But the generator for this thing lives on the roof of the building. And the roof is only one floor above because the entire building is 21 stories high. We've got NY2, the 8th floor. The generator for that is on street level, so 8 stories below it. The fuel tanks for each are located in the basement. As per fire codes after 9/11, you cannot have it anywhere higher than the basement, to our and everyone else's chagrin during this. And both have pump systems down there, and both have automatic transfer switches. The function of an automatic transfer switch is to detect when utility power has been cut, and to seamlessly transition over to generator power when the generator can handle the load that the utility power was handling. And the 21st floor has enough UPS for 15 minutes, and the 8th floor has enough UPS for 20 minutes. And in New Jersey, this is going to be New York focused because that's where I was, but a few facts about New Jersey. New Jersey also has this, the same amount of fuel tanks. They were in general more ready for this because they're serviced by PSENG. And if you know anything about PSENG, they make Con Ed look immaculate. We joke that PSENG in New Jersey is our backup power source, with the generators being the primary. It fails often is what I'm saying, so they're very well tested. The transfer switches everything. So we felt fairly confident that it was going to be just fine. And in New York, we test for generators the third Wednesday of every month. All other backup equipment, so the transfer switches and the UPSs, are unit tested regularly. We don't, on a regular basis, do stuff like disconnect utility power and make sure that everything from there works automatically because we feel the risk to be a bit high. But we do know that the system, as we have it, automatically worked in 2003 when Level 3 had the facility during that giant northeastern blackout. But we took it over shortly after that, and since we've taken it over, the building has not lost power, so we've not tested the system as a whole, just piecemeal.
Mark, can I ask a question?
Please.
So, I'm curious about when you're doing testing, because, you know, the ideal conditions of war are never met, that type of thing. I mean, do you actually go in a position where you're doing testing when, if your testing fails, your clients go down? I mean,
no.
Do you prepare people? I mean, how do you deal?
During our tests, we do not put customers at risk.
Then how do you know it's going to work when they are?
I'm not an electrician, and these two people are raising their hands.
I can sort of mention that. We have this sort of expensive device called a load tester. So it basically sucks out and has a bunch of power to try to manage what you go to the data center. Obviously, it means you're not testing everything, but you're still investing in the ability to pump out the PDUs you need for the generator.
But if that doesn't mean the PDU in the cabinet or at the end of the hall of the aisle is still work. Do you know what I mean? I'm just curious, how far can you go?
Sure.
Specific readiness for Sandy. We resisted the urge to sort of half-ass it because nothing happened during Irene. A lot of like civilians sort of just, you know, didn't take it as seriously as they did Irene because they felt that was the city crying wolf. We resisted that urge to good effect. We filled up our fuel tanks. We actually overfilled them. A huge thing you can do when you've got like 8 or 21 stories of pipes between your main tanks and generators is you can sort of run the generator a bit while filling it, and the pipes actually have a couple hundred gallons of fuel in them. So instead of like 3,000 gallons, we get like 3,500, depending on how many floors the generator is above the fuel tank. We pre-scheduled daily fuel deliveries from a bunch of companies. And not that we had anything to do with it, but we were in flood zone C, which was the only chance you had of survival in lower Manhattan. Comically, A and B were one block downhill in either direction. So we were on sort of this hill, and it saved us just. We called in all available staff. If you were a technician and you drew a salary from the company, you were in New Jersey, if you worked there the evening of, and you were in New York the evening of. We stocked up food for a couple of days, because we thought that at worst, things would be bad for only a couple of days. As we will learn, this did not work out quite as well. I brought a blanket and a pillow, sort of preparing for slightly more than being a couple of days there.
Of course.
Yep.
What kind of fuel do you guys use? Was it hard to get it after the fact?
There's a whole section on this.
Sorry.
Excellent question. So it's the evening, and the sun is setting, and our building engineer comes in and solemnly tells us that they've been informed by Con Ed that 100% they will shut off power, it's just a matter of when. And so we split up into teams. We have the 21st floor team, which is responsible for that transfer switch, the roof generator. I'll repeat this, the roof generator during Sandy, on the roof, 21 stories above the ground. The 8th floor responsible for the transfer switch there, and the basement are responsible for pumps, fuel tanks, and the street level generator for the 8th floor. We don't assume anything is going to work automatically, so we switch to like the ideal system administrator operating mode. We make no positive assumptions about anything. So we know how to start the generators manually if required. We know how to flip the giant switches to transfer power from utility generators if required. And people will walk around and check every single bit of backup power infrastructure routinely throughout the whole ordeal.
This is Monday night, right?
Yes.
7 p.m.
Yeah. We all showed up there Sunday afternoon. Like, I showed up at about 5 p.m. on Sunday because 2 hours short of when they were going to shut the subways off because I had no way of getting there after that. So, yeah, it's Monday night. And so the building tells us this at like 6:55 p.m. And I complain that this is a dick move. They should either not tell us when they're going to do it and just, or just tell us when they're going to do it. Telling us they're going to do it and not telling us when is sort of the worst combination in terms of psychological pain. But fortunately, 5 minutes after I complain, at 7 p.m. sharp, it goes dark. Fulton and Bowling Green substations are gone, kind of shut them down. We've lost utility power. So where we're sitting, there are no windows. And so it's pitch black. And so what seems like several minutes, but I looked at my laptop to see how long it had been on battery power. It was actually 12 seconds, of course. But it's pitch black. It's pitch black for 12 seconds, and we all like stay really calm, turn our flashlights on, and say, "Okay, go. You know, you go check the generator. You go check the switch." And as we're standing in front of the switch, and I go into the data center because we've been told that there is a very loud noise emanating from the automatic transfer switch. Because to make the transfer from utility power to generator power very quickly, there is a giant and powerful spring that moves the physical circuit over. And so as Kevin and those guys in the back went like a few feet in front of this thing, and I was sort of running away from it, I heard it like, and then lights came on. So all the automatic gear, all the UPSs worked. We have only essential equipment on UPSs, which means just the data centers and the switching gear. In the network operations centers, all our desktops and laptops and stuff, not on the UPS, because we can live without them, and we can use the power to power customer equipment. So they all rebooted, whatever, doesn't matter. None of the lights are on UPS. Okay, so all that stuff went dark and then came back up. We went through all the cabinets, checked all the switches, nothing lost power, everything transferred as well as could have been hoped. Now getting to the manual checking of systems part. A guy, Richard and I, were assigned to roof generator duty. So it was about 7:30 p.m. 80 mile an hour winds on the ground, slightly higher, we didn't measure it, on the roof. Sorry. I'll make sure to move it every now and then. Thank you. And so we go up there. We assume that the wind is like 100 miles an hour, so we don't want to go there just as is. So we find a very sturdy rope, and I tie the rope around an exposed column of the building out on the roof. And I strap this guy in, and we do a little test run, and it seems to work. I'm the weight, he goes out in his like reindeer and checks it. As it turns out, this wasn't necessary because in front of 100 William Street, and when I say in front, I mean downwind of the storm.
Did you learn this at Poly?
What?
Did you learn this at Poly?
Learn what?
The world thing?
Nope. A Poly education is not that real world. So 110 William Street, which is several, like, dozen stories higher than ours, was downwind of the storm from our building. And so it actually blunted the 100 or so mile an hour winds to something that we could tolerate. It was like 40, 50. And so we went up there, we checked the generator. It was working. And we had to do this every now and then, which would later prove critical in our survival during this ordeal. So that's us. At the same time, we had the basement crew checking that the fuel pumps were working, and they were. And we also noted that the building had their own generator, which is critical to us because it provides things like the freight elevator. Regular elevators were shut off. The freight elevator was all we had. If we couldn't use it, we would have to hike down 21 flights of stairs. So we had a vested interest in having that thing running. But the basement crew noted that at about 9 p.m., which was high tide during Sandy, the sump pumps of the building became overwhelmed by the storm surge, despite us being in flood zone C. And so there were two building inspectors who were on duty, literally, with brooms and squeegees, frantically...
Yeah!
Thank you.
Awesome.
Good volume?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Sorry about that, but I didn't want to wait here.
That's all right. And so at about 9 p.m., the sump pumps of the building were being overwhelmed by the storm surge, and they were frantically shoveling water with brooms and squeegees back into the sump pumps to prevent the water from going over this barrier that they had around the sump pump. Because, you know, if the water gets out of that barrier, ain't no getting it back in. And they succeeded. For about an hour, they had to do this. But it worked, and of course they were yelling like very heavy obscenities at each other and just out into the general wind while doing this. I'm sure it was very stressful for them. We survived that. Some things we noticed that blunted our service a little bit, but not critically. The Verizon DSL line went away, and in case you're one of the people who doesn't know why, this is why. This is the lobby. Of the building where Verizon telco lines were. So this contained the copper for like all of the financial district. So DSL, Cox Lines, T1, T3, you know. Even if you didn't have service explicitly from Verizon, you may know that Verizon owns the physical lines, and anyone who transferred packets over still has to use Verizon lines. So all that just went away.
Did people fare better with VLEX?
What's that?
Building local exchange carriers, so like if it's fiber or copper and they actually are less mile themselves, separate from Verizon, say AT&T's fiber or something like that, did anybody fare better with that or not?
I'm not sure. I do have a fiber if it's like a straight run. It will feel much better with water because it does not conduct electrons like copper does. I think you can just sort of submerge it to some extent. I'm not sure. So Verizon DSL went away. Our phones went away. The New York International Internet Exchange went away because they run like telehouse. And a lot of competition went away. Some internet went away, some datagram went away, just a bunch of people. And early in the morning, after the storm had set and before the sun rose, the other guy, Ivan, picked up some flashlights and went out exploring the neighborhood. It was pitch black. There were roving bands of policemen and utility workers with flashlights surveying the damage. You could not hear any human or machine-made noise, just a very loud sort of howling wind. We went south to the South Street Seaport. It became increasingly windy and colder, but it was about 30 degrees cooler than the previous night. And we decided to turn back when the debris that was flying around exceeded the size, which would probably kill us if it hit us, because that was still flying around. And so we turned back and we go out when it was light out. So, digging in. building management wasn't around. They were on vacation in California. It was going on.
Did it really matter though?
It helped us. We don't want them to be there, right? So it was us, the building engineers, and building security. The building was on lockdown. Security would not let any other company through. In fact, the only reason that the building is open 24/7 is because of our lease. We're a 24/7 company. And if somebody wanted to get in, they would log and they'd say that they work for us, and they would have security call us up, and we'd say, yep, and they'd come up. Any of you guys know the Tier 1 Squarespace situation, the Bucket Brigade? Raise your hand if you have not heard of this. It's a good story. Okay, a story worth telling. It's 55 Broad Street, right? Just so I have the address. Okay, let's say it's 55 Broad Street. This thing was underwater. 55 Broad Street was underwater. And the hosting facility there was called Tier 1. And they had some situation where, because they were flooded, the pump got flooded and the tank got flooded. And so they could not pump fuel from their main tank up to their day tank. The day tank is the locally attached unit of the generator. That's like a few hundred gallons, a couple of hours. And not to give up, they paid $25,000 for a diesel truck to come and park across the street. And they had a bucket brigade. So they carried, I think, 5 gallon drums full of diesel fuel up, I want to say, a dozen stories, and refilled the fuel tank, the day tank. And Squarespace was a Tier 1 customer who was instrumental in this bucket brigade, and they contacted us because they had heard that we were still alive. And we generously...
75,
thank you.
Okay. 55 was miles off.
Okay. Also dead, I believe. Yeah.
Facing.
Yep. And so Squarespace contacted us because they heard that we were still up. And they said, oh yeah, we work here. And we said, yeah, we do. And they came up to our 8th floor client lounge, sort of planned their grand survival strategy out of MII's client lounge, despite being a competitor. And we got hotel rooms to like sleep and shower in a bit later as we realized that this was not going to go away after 2 days. And we also gave them one of our hotel rooms to recuperate a bit. So regarding multiple fuel trucks mentioned earlier that were supposed to come every morning, we had multiple sort of parallel delivery schedules, so like 9,000-12,000 gallons of fuel every morning because the fuel situation was not great. Bridges were initially shut down, so strictly speaking, the fuel providers had no way of getting the stuff to us physically because it was all coming from Jersey. And when they opened up, the Port Authority had some rules in place where you had to have like multiple people in your car to get on the bridge. But this was either rescinded or the fuel people got around it somehow, and the fuel was more or less on time. And whoever got to us first, we pointed up and we called everyone else and said, well, we're good for now, but please come back tomorrow. This is not a cost-optimized strategy by any stretch of the imagination. This is strictly reliability optimized.
You asked 3 different people to the dance, but only went with 1.
That's right.
Doesn't work every time.
No.
What was your hit ratio? What was the hit ratio here? Like how many people did not make it?
Well, we called as soon as the first one came. Like we tried to be as courteous as possible, given our dickishness. And so we called everyone else and said, oh, we're good. So we never had like two pulling up the same thing. And since we had a vested interest in building systems working, oh yeah, and another building system, the water pumps, so that we can have toilets and stuff on the 21st floor, also important. So it was in our best interest to have the building generator running. And of course, they did not have any emergency fuel contracts, and they did not contact anybody about fuel. But we graciously encouraged them to take some of ours to keep the elevator and water pumps running. We shut down towards the end, maybe about 3 or 4 cabinets worth of servers. it started being very conservative at the beginning. So where we have a master and a backup, we turned the backup off for the duration of this event. But as the situation became more and more prolonged, it sort of became aggressive. Like development and staging servers that we managed for customers that they had access to. So like if it wasn't in production, we'd shut it down and wait until they complain and ask for us to turn it back on. Just all for saving power, therefore fuel, and also increasing the lifespan of our generators. Some staff worked anywhere between 12 and 36 hour shifts during this. So in addition to regular data center operations, which require some amount of work, we had no less than a dozen people each hour asking, oh, what are your generator statistics? Do you plan to survive this? What do I do if your facility goes down? And of course, this is the perfect time to plan for it, right? There was also a large uptick in business due to Datagram, et cetera, customers literally just moving cabinets into our facility. Some city jersey. People just drove their stuff. Staff who was primarily computer based in nature had to assume certain new roles. So we have an in-house electrician, he's really good, but he was in New Jersey for the start of the storm. And given the traffic and fuel situation for the first few days of the scenario, he was sort of stuck there. Now, if you recall, we had sort of visual confirmation that everything was working. One time, we went to the basement, scheduled, and we looked at the fuel pump for the 21st floor. And there's normally an LED display that says, in gallons, how much fuel is left in the tank. And it tells the pump when to pump and when not to. The person who came there looked at the display, and the display was off. And the pump was off. So, he called a more senior member of the staff down. And the senior member of the staff realized that his cell phone did not work in the basement to call our electrician in New Jersey. So, another person got up on the third floor with a walkie-talkie, and we had the guy at the panel with a walkie-talkie relaying instructions over the walkie-talkie to the guy on the third floor who was on his phone with our electrician in New Jersey. A cell phone picture of the wires in the panel was sent to our electrician in New Jersey, and using this relay system, throughout the course of two very stressful hours, we determined that it was A, the problem was a faulty circuit breaker, a GFI circuit breaker, which is designed to turn off as opposed to like spark if it comes exposed to water. A post-mortem of the situation revealed that when construction workers were doing some construction above the area of the basement where the 21 gear was, they sort of left some cracks or whatever that let water through during the storm, and so water slowly seep into our pump control system and ruin this GFI breaker. So if we tried to turn it on, it would begin to be turned off. So in some kind of bomb disarming-like situation using this relay system, the electrician from New Jersey told this guy at the panel which wires to rearrange in what format. We had to hunt for a similar end-off circuit breaker and take the GFI one out and put another regular one in. And after about 2 hours, it was such that we had this thing pumping through again. So management became electrician there. We have human generators, and we have some people from HO Penn who are experts in them. And they come and do the testing and service it and everything. They were busy. They were busy like getting hospitals and stuff online. So they'd come after we called them, eventually they wouldn't stay for too long. They did the minimum possible amount of work that they had to sort of get things running and teach us how to do the rest. Now the thing about a diesel generator is that stuff gets into the fuel tank, water, debris, and generators don't burn that for energy very well. In fact, it causes them to stall if there's too much of it. So there are filters inside generators to filter this stuff out. And so during our routine checks one day, would go up to the roof generator. And it was such a change of scenery because it's just beautiful and sunny out, but the business situation is still zombie apocalypse. But we check the panel, and there's a red LED on the panel. And we call these guys, and they come, and they put a computer with some special software into it, and it tells them, this thing is going to install soon because the filter is dirty. And so they change it. They change the filter once, and they teach us how to do it for the remainder of the filter change operations. And they tell us to do it every, like, about 12, 24 hours. And they so next time you do this, I'd say your system administrator becomes a generator contractor. And the first time he changed it, he was wearing glasses because he was sweaty because of the whole situation. When you take the fuel filter out, there's some negative pressure due to the inner workings of the turbine of the generator. And so the generator sort of sucked his glasses off his face and into the generator. Now, it didn't land in any critical part of it, and we don't know that it landing in any critical part of it would make a difference. The machinery may have been powerful enough to just grind it into glasses, I don't know. But that's the thing that happened. And he couldn't reach it with his hand. And so the other senior system administrator who was assisting him reached his glasses out with the broom handle. Yes. And there was nowhere to buy fruit from 4 miles around. So the other thing that manager became is what we refer to as the food administrators. Coming up. So changing gears a bit, this is the story that you inquired about. You're going to get your fill. So initially, our generators were fueled by something called ultra-low sulfur diesel, and this is self-explanatory. It's diesel with very low sulfur in it. It's very environmentally friendly, no pollution, smell is not so bad. And it's very environmentally friendly. And our first delivery went for $3.54 a gallon.
Yeah.
And about the third day, since, you know, we're like one of the several cities and states that are using this to stay alive, this became scarce. And so deliveries were then switched to just straight up heating oil, which is the same thing, except they do not care about the sulfur content. And it violates all kinds of local ordinances to run a generator that exhausts after the street running this, but, you know, who cares? And the price of this thing went up throughout this ordeal. And on our 13th day of getting this delivered, which was in New Jersey, at that point, New York was already on utility power, this was $8 a gallon. And the thing about this heating oil variant is, for the situation, it was $1 a gallon. So we had it rise 800% in 2 weeks.
Morris, at any point did anybody try to tell you JP7 to burn everything?
Not that I'm aware of.
What was that?
So you can burn JP7 jet fuel in diesel engines, and there's some other colo facilities in New Jersey that somehow got their hands on surplus jet fuel and they're hitting their generators. It's something that the military does because they don't want to have like separate fuel for separate things, but it's not legal.
Right, like green gas in cars.
Yeah, or, you know, type 3 fuel oil and, you know, commercial generators.
Yeah, we don't run out the window for this and other events we mentioned.
Had anybody ever inquired about it? Is there any repercussion of burning it?
Is it the low sulfur fuel?
No, I mean the type 3 fuel oil.
Oh, right, that's what I meant. No one in the position. So I mentioned that we had these hotel rooms across the street, right? And one time when we were hanging out around the street level generator, a woman patron of this hotel came up to us and asked if we were responsible for this generator emanating the disgusting sulfur fumes, and we said yeah. And she said, I can't sleep at night because this thing smells so bad. You gotta turn it off.
Would you like to watch it?
By the way, my internet's broken.
Yeah, this is the only known to me instance of this. So initially, if you guys know, there are kind of refineries like just on the coast as you go across the river bridge, leads to Newark and everything. And initially, fuel came from there. It's relatively close, and so it was relatively cheap. It came from there because it was stored sort of pre-diesel, whatever the chemical designation is, but it was diesel straight to fuel trucks and send out. And normally when those giant containers of this thing at the refinery run out, they refine some more diesel on an on-demand basis. The thing is, in Sandy, after these things have been drained, all those refineries were offline because they did not have power. So I'll rephrase that and reiterate it. The things responsible for generator fuel did not have power to make more. And as a result of this, our fuel companies eventually had to start going to Trenton, 8 miles farther away, to get our fuel. This contributed to the dramatic price increases of our fuel.
They can't generate their own power because of, monopoly laws.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Huh.
What's that?
Because of, monopoly laws? What are those called? Antitrust laws?
Yeah, price gouging.
No.
Antitrust laws will not allow a factory to generate its own power. So.
That's a fun fact. So that's on the generator power front. Car fuel, gasoline, was also becoming scarce and was sort of and also a rather important resource. So staff sort of went home with regular frequency after like day four when we had things sort of leveled out. Aside from that, building engineers and building garage people and building security went home more frequently. They also like some fuel. Customers going about their regular business like fuel. And I mentioned the numerous customers of data centers that were offline, very desperately wanted some fuel so that they could haul off their servers from those data centers to, the deal was if you give you fuel, it's going to our facility and you're signing a service order. So they could have used some fuel. So Governor, I forgot his name. New Jersey one.
Christie,
yes. He enacted fuel ration laws in New Jersey when this thing began. But there was an exception for filling containers with gas. So we bought these 15-gallon drums. And we had a New Jersey employee drive to Cherry Hill, where we found some sort of vacant gas station. This was 60 miles away from our New Jersey data center. He would fill up like 3 or 4 of these 15-gallon drums, put some in his trunk, put some in the back of his car, drive it back to Bridgewater, to our New Jersey data center, where it would be distributed to customers and our security guard and staff and all these people. And then management, also the gas administrator, take the remainder to take 2 of these in his trunk, in his back seat, and drive it into New York City, across a bridge. Now, if you know anything about environmental and like federal laws about this, this is illegal.
That's
a bomb on a bridge.
Yeah.
That's a bomb on a bridge. But like I said, laws. And so when he got them into New York City, we would distribute them, we would bribe like the garage people and the building security to let more people in when they sort of realized that you can't possibly have 100 people working for you coming up using your client lounge and stuff. It's kind of quiet along with other things to be mentioned. And it was funny because there was sort of a localized economic collapse within the zone without power. Money didn't need very much inside it. Gas meant something, food meant something. Money, everyone had some. They wanted something else and they couldn't get it inside the zone. Barter economy. So we had stocked little trenches for a couple of days because we thought that this was the worst case scenario. It would be, gone for a couple of days and then Kylie would come around and fix it and we'd all go home. No. Food ran out on the second day or so. And you couldn't, go downstairs and go across the street and buy yourself a slice of pizza. There was no food for miles around. there's just no food. And so getting across heat bridge at that point was prohibitive in that you would have to take a large portion of the staff because they had these HRP rules on them and had no open bridges. Towns were flooded, so you had to go north. And north meant north of 39th Street, so this was a decent drive. And at night it was particularly tricky because there were no traffic lights and there were no street lights. So it was sort of a free-for-all, except every now and then you would see a cop car sort of going at 40, 50 miles an hour, full lights on, as a police car. Nobody would pass them for fear of them doing something to you. But basically, this was the rule. We just followed the cop car and don't pass it, and you get north of 39th Street, where there is civilization and streetlights and things. And through every time today, someone from management, the administrator, would take this journey and bring back, like, a trunk full of food. Breakfast was a particularly interesting exercise. Our VP or president would wake up at about 6 or 7 in the morning, and he would find a Dunkin' Donuts or Tim Hortons that was nearby, and he would literally buy them out of all the breakfast sandwiches they had prepared at the time. This was several dozen. Some were for us. But the thing is, the other commodity, aside from fuel that's valuable in sort of a social collapse situation, is food. So garage security, building security, police were very receptive to being bribed by a breakfast sandwich. Everybody was just a lot more helpful if they saw our stock of breakfast sandwiches and we just volunteered them for them. So at one point, after things had settled down, we wondered when we were going to get utility power back. Kind of doesn't provide this. So Monday evening we lost power, and on about Wednesday we were wondering when we were going to get back, since we were past our two-day, or it was going to last only 2 days deadline. And we eventually came across the kind of outage map for Lower Manhattan. And we realized that even though the surrounding buildings were on their outage map marked as there's an outage, ours wasn't. So the thing is, since building management was in California, and nobody had taken the initiative, and by the way, we get our power through the building. We don't buy directly from Con Ed, although we have our own separate 2,000 amp feet for the 21st floor because the building doesn't have enough. But still, we interface with Con Ed through the building. But the building did not take the initiative to report our building as down. Nor did we know that our building had to explicitly report as down to kind of figure, oh, they know that this is fed by the substation, they shut down. No, we had to tell them. I'm going to say, 3 days later, that we were out. So we told them. But, you know, they're busy guys having the city to restore. And so it took them about a day to send over the first of their examination teams, and this team's job was to get into the, it's called a vault, where the Con Ed switching equipment is in the basement of the building, to determine that it did not get wet, and it did not get wet, because we had industrious building engineers fighting the water away with squeegees and brooms.
Yeah, cursing.
Yes, that's right. So they came about on Thursday, and they spent literally a minute there and told us, oh yeah, it's dry. And we were kind of upset about this since, you know, they could have been there Tuesday morning. So after that, they told us, now we have to get a different set of people to come on and turn the actual power on. These guys took about 1.5 days to arrive. And during this, we were getting a bit finicky because we were already exceeding our rated lifespan of generator for continuous operation. There were all sorts of internal components that had to be shut off for an extended period of time to service that we didn't want to do. And so Con Ed had set up these mobile command centers around the financial district, and we'd sort of run to each one of them, sort of into a few groups, and we would ask these guys, oh, do you know anything about 100 Wilson Street, do you know anything about 100 Wilson Street? And half of them said, oh, we're here for the scene, go talk to these other people. And the other people said, we'll get to you when we're good and ready. And so, late Friday, they were getting ready, and they came by into the vault. And so our building engineer, who had made his way to our facility at this point, was going over, like, Con Ed electrical blueprints with them sprawled out on the floor. And eventually they got into the vault, they flipped the switch and allowed bang to mist. And this building, like, power display, you know, showed up 480 volts of three-phase power. And then our building electrician flipped the big switch, building switch, and that allowed bang to mist, at which point the building had power. And our automatic counter switches are configured such that there's a timer, a 30-minute timer, and it starts counting down when the city power is restored. This is to make sure the power is stable, because it trips every time it gets lost. And so after half an hour, it would automatically switch power from generator to utility, and after another period of time, it shuts the generator down gracefully. This countdown started for us. In the meantime, our building does not have their own electrician. They have a third-party contractor. Now, prior to having time to turn the building power on, the building electrician went and turned off all the circuit breakers so as to protect equipment, I don't know. So that had to be done all over again in reverse by the building electrician. And after getting through a couple of floors, he actually rage quit. He just left without saying anything, without tiring out the rest of the building, because he was, like, tired of it. And so our in-house electrician went around about 19 floors of 100 William Street and powered up all the floors that did not belong to us. We were very charitable in all sorts of ways during this ordeal. So some statistics, after it was all over, across all facilities, we burned about 60,000 gallons of low sulfur and high sulfur diesel and heating oil. The New York generators operated continuously for 6 days, which is about 20% past what they were supposed to do continuously. The 21st floor one, running almost at full load the whole time, about 1,300 amps out of the 1,600 they can do. The 8th floor one, not as highly taxed because there's less stuff down there. And replaced the external fuel filter multiple times to keep it from stalling because there was junk in the fuel. In New Jersey, two weeks of guys that were without power. And not only at work, each and every one of them did not have power in their apartments and houses during this thing. So this was a kind of psychological ordeal for them especially. Also, multiple external fuel filter replacements for them. And on day 12, their generator was shut down and UPS power fed the facility for about 5 minutes, while the in-house electrician and generator maintenance crew and the senior staff member there replaced the internal fuel filter because it was about to stall and it was time to change that guy. And then it ran another day after that before PSE&G gave us power back. And if I just summarize my experience in one sentence, it would be when everybody activates their disaster recovery strategy at the same time, you're on your own. Because the thing about disaster recovery resources is that they're overcommitted.
Out of curiosity,
yep.
Because you had to run those generators well past what they're rated for, did you actually have to replace any of the generators?
Nope.
And they're still running as expected, even having run well past what they're designed for.
They start behaving in certain ways when they get stressed. So, under ideal conditions, for example, a 1600 amp generator will give you 1600 amps of current. As the internal fuel filter becomes clogged, even if the external fuel filter has just been changed, it can't get any fuel through to the burn system to generate all those amps, so it cannot get to 1600. And the voltage might drop, and the frequency might drop. This kind of thing starts happening if the thing is run under very high wear and very high load for longer than it's rated for, like a car.
But then you replace the internal fuel filter, and it's...
To replace the internal filter, you have to shut it down. We did not want to do this in New York. We had to end up doing it in New Jersey. So there are two sets of filters, external, which you can do online, internal, which you have to turn it off for. Is that clear?
Yes.
Okay.
So no component of the generator is actually got damaged.
No. The filters aren't meant to be replaced, so that was within sort of operational scope.
So there was no permanent damage to the...
That's right. No permanent damage to the generators.
Of course. These are straight generators, it's not like inverter generators, so if they lose RPMs, they do start to fluctuate the frequency and output.
We've had some frequency fluctuation in Jersey. I don't know the answer to your question. Any staff members in the back would answer that?
Are they straight generators or are they inverting generators? Do they create DC and convert it back to AC and convert it?
I don't think they do the converting. I think that's how they
do. Yes.
Have you changed anything in your TR plans based on your experience with gas generators?
More fuel, more food, I should say. Our fuels have worked out fine.
What do you mean? I'm sorry, more fuel. What does that mean? Food. Like you have four delivery trucks coming?
No, that was a slip of the tongue. I said I wanted to say more food.
More food.
Maybe canned food, that doesn't go bad. The fuels have worked out fine. That strategy worked. We only had one delivery that was late by a couple of hours, and we in fact had a contingency plan at the time. So if you recall, the 21 generator burned at a rate about three or four times higher than the 8 generator, which meant that since they had the same amount of fuel in the tanks, which we topped off every day, we could transfer fuel from 8 to 21. And so we devised an ingenious system with a pump and a hose that would transfer fuel from one to the other until the filter came. But we did not have to put that into play. It came early enough that we had enough fuel up to run. Yeah, unfortunately. And I have some choice quotes here from our IRC channel during the ordeal to end on a comical note.
Where is Lynn? Where are these quotes from?
Right.
Jersey, New York.
So Lynn is a New Jersey staff member. That was on the evening of. So that's when things were here to ban New Jersey. And everybody else is New York staff. Question?
Yeah. Network connectivity. There's a lot of physical, a lot of power, and these appear to be the primary concerns. Actual network connectivity. What was going on with you guys?
Surprisingly good. So our main carriers, level 3 above net, now Zio, Packet Exchange, now GTT, and Zima, now also GTT. Global Crossing, now level 3. Optimum Lightcast, I think, is all of them. All the major carriers did not lose a packet. No BGP signal bounced. So they either had their generators stuck together, or they were not anywhere that lost power, which is possible because our 1 gig and 10 gig lines are single mode fiber, which, as you know, can be run for like kilometers in any direction, so they could be well out of the path of the electrical problems. Just the one I mentioned, New York International Engine Exchange, which appeared with all kinds of people, Google, Twitter, Yahoo, whatever, they went down. They landed on a Telex power outage, but, we didn't investigate, we don't really care. Those guys are not reliable when there is power, so we're not really surprised they went down. The only reason they stayed up, in fact, is because a year prior, just during no kind of storm activity or electrical problems, their UPSs broke because of neglect, of just years of neglect, and they were down for like 8 hours. A major Northeastern internet exchange is down for 8 hours because their UPSs were not cared for. Their batteries were not replaced in a timely fashion. And ever since then, they've been overcorrecting. Like, they spam us with at least 2 emails a week scheduling generator tests and ensuring that during generator tests, we, the customers, are not at risk. And you feel that because of this, they survived like even 1 second during Sandy. Because we didn't have to stay in generator, but it didn't work out for them ideally. They were down for a couple of hours. But overall, networking was surprisingly healthy.
And Have you guys looked at, or did you guys even think to look at the actual overall facility usage and like network usage and systems usage from customer systems throughout this event? Because watching like the various internet traffic stuff online all day Monday was totally fascinating to see how.
I don't think that we did. We were concerned with like survival at that point.
Yeah.
But what kind of stuff did you see?
The Eastern Seaboard, it's particularly between New York, Boston, New York, DC Metro, was completely hosed. And the, you know, a lot of the discussion, a lot of what people were talking about was this is people who are suddenly telecommuting for the day to work. Nobody went to work.
Right.
Right. So then they have this huge overabundance of communication about the storm, about storm preparedness, people running backups from various companies, like this idea of, oh, wow, get our stuff out of the East Coast. And then a few lines to, in particular, Chicago from New York were sort of hot. Yeah, but it wasn't as bad as like all that East Coast action. And a lot of the, again, the assumptions are people backing up, people taking all of those database dumps that they've
really taken, and all that fun stuff. Yeah, I didn't specifically check what was going on there, but I do know that a major managed customer of ours, for whom we run a couple of cabinets, Weather Media, Rolling Stone, Us Magazine, and Journal, they did not report to work, but they inundated us annoyingly with requests to like whitelist 100 IPs because they were all working from home. So there was that. We had increased just routine bandwidth from all the new customers which we took in, which was several patents worth by the end of this thing. I didn't think to check MRTG at the time. Yep.
In terms of the systems in general, what obviously eventually this happens, this is when you find out where the brittle parts are, right?
Sure.
You have a brittleness that is kind of opened up. It could be a third party, NYIX, obviously. It could be whatever.
No. Well, they fell all the time. That's a known brittleness.
Right. So actually, they were a problem in many ways because it was an assumption that they had been down before. So, right, it wasn't like rubble all the time. But there was a question of what you're doing differently now in terms of DR.
Yeah, sure. So
more broadly, can you answer that?
So we've got a New York facility, a New Jersey facility, an LA facility. The LA facility existed at the time. And now we have a Seattle facility, which did not exist at the time. So we're on two coasts and four states. So, you know, it obviously makes sense to distribute services throughout those four sites. Now, some are easier than others, you know, like a website or a database server is a difficult thing to make this happen. But sort of the low-hanging fruit like DNS. DNS does itself extremely well with this. So one thing that we've done since is we distribute various authoritative DNS services, both for internal and one on, and we host a major for customers, like thousands of them. Those are living in those four facilities, stuff like that. Okay, there's the talk. Thank you.